when council have set up in the marriage of his case. I'm not rushing, I realize.
May it please the court, my name is Lauren Quiet, registration 14687 from Baker and Hosteller. On behalf of the co-petitioner appellant, Father Kerry Hicks. In this case, your honors, the trial court abused its discretion in failing to reduce father's child support obligation and then compounded that abuse by then increasing father's child support obligation at the same hearing. The evidence at the hearing was shockingly ignored by the court, and in particular, several areas that I will address this morning. One, the undisputed evidence was that father's income had decreased approximately 50% from 1998, when the child support order was established at the time of the divorce, to the time of the hearing in August of 2007. Court further overestimated father's income because impermissibly excluded evidence which had been stipulated to by the parties regarding a $250,000 capital loss which father had sustained in 2006, the year just prior to the hearing. That was Exhibit L. The court then inappropriately, in our opinion, and abused its discretion in finding mother's income. This is an area that I'll refer back to the brief on, since I don't believe I'll have enough time to get into it. But it clearly inappropriately found mother's income. It ignored her 2006 tax return information. It ignored the $400,000 worth of capital gains she had achieved in the first half of 2007 before our hearing. And finally, your honors, the evidence will show that the court abused its discretion in determining the expenses, mother's expenses, relating to the party's daughter's, Melinda, reasonable needs. They've decreased since the time of the hearing. The matter came before, to put the matter in context, the matter came before the court on father's motion to modify child support. As I mentioned, child support had not been modified since 1998 at the time of the divorce, and since that time, father's parenting time with the daughter had increased from roughly 65 overnights, which we refer to as a Schedule A, to halftime, 50% of the time, 182 overnights. The multiple abuses by the trial court set forth in the brief, the highlights being, the two main highlights I want to focus on today, are father's income. The court, as I mentioned, impermissibly excluded the evidence. In fact, it referred to Exhibit L, the $250,000 loss, as unauthenticated hearsay. Those were the trial court's words. The parties, as part of the pre-hearing activities, stipulated to the admission of certain exhibits, certain evidence. This was done for several reasons. Of course, one of the reasons is the courts are always pounding on us lawyers is to streamline the case. We have very little time. The courts are overburdened. We all understand it. So we streamline our cases. We determine in advance with opposing counsel what we can stipulate to and what we can't. In this case, we stipulated to Exhibit L, which was the letter from the manager of the investment that father had of a $250,000 loss he was going to sustain in 2006 for purposes of his taxes. Okay, that was stipulated to. The trial court had no problem accepting the stipulation. In fact, I read it into the record as I stood at the lectern for opening argument. Court accepted it. It's commonplace. It's commonplace in all trials to stipulate to the admission of evidence. Had the parties not reached a stipulation, father would have certainly called the manager, would have certainly had other witnesses to testify to authenticate a document. It's not that hard to do. It wouldn't have been hearsay. It would have come into evidence. Rather than saying something at the hearing where I would have had a chance to do something, the court in its August 31st, 2007 order referred to it as unauthenticated hearsay. This loss should have been considered in the same manner as if father had a capital gain in that year. In both situations, it should be used to calculate father's income under CRS 1410.115. Had it been properly considered, father's income would have been roughly $260,000 in the year 2006 that the court was focusing on, which, when you compare it to mother's income, as I've referenced in our briefs, would have been roughly equal to or similar as her income.
Mr. Quiet, let me ask you, let's assume that advisor had come in and testified but had no documents to support it and simply was saying he is going to experience a $250,000 loss.
So no documents other than the letter he produced?
Just he doesn't even, I mean, as I understand it, the letter is no better than his testimony.
Probably true, Your Honor.
So he comes in, he testifies, he says he's going to experience $250,000 loss, and you present no documentation to demonstrate that.
But Your Honor, I would argue to you that a witness's testimony is just as good as a piece of paper, and the court could have made a credibility determination at that time, but it would have been faced with the fact of it would have been unrefuted. There was no way, and there was no attempt, because it had been stipulated to refute that loss. So it would have been unrefuted evidence. Could the court have said, yes, I heard the manager of that investment testify, but I don't believe him for a minute? I would argue to you that would have been within the discretion of the court, absolutely, if there was something. But we never got to that. We never got to that because we stipulated to it. You know, lawyers practice in an era where stipulations mean something, that we focus on them, that we say, okay, I've got this into evidence. It's coming in. I don't have to worry about the authentic.
But we also negotiate as to whether it's a stipulation of fact or a stipulation of testimony or a stipulation of the admissibility of a document. You guys could have stipulated, as a matter of fact, that he was going to have a $250,000 loss. The court would have been bound by that. But when you testify that this letter is authentic, you're saying the court can't say, that's fine, but I find that to be hearsay and I can't consider it. I'm not going to consider it.
But in addition, Your Honor, in addition to the letter that I had Mr. Hicks's, the father's testimony, which supported that. So I had two things. So I had them both in there, Your Honor.
Okay, go ahead.
Quite frankly, Your Honor, there's no justifiable reason why the court would state that a stipulated exhibit was unauthenticated hearsay. This error alone, Your Honors, should cause this court to reverse the trial court's order and remand this case back for new hearing.
Would we necessarily remand it for new hearing or just new findings? I mean, if that's the only error we find.
If that's the only error you find, then what we have is a situation for new findings. That would be true, Your Honor, because we'd have, and we'd make argument to the court about what those findings really meant. Your Honor, with regard to the other argument that I want to raise, the other highlight that I want to raise here at the court, is that the trial court abused its discretion in awarding mother child support that exceeded the reasonable needs of the child. And there's two components of this argument. The first is that it miscalculated the child's needs. To start with, this trial court used a 2004 number for the reasonable needs of the child, rather than the evidence it had in front of it at the hearing of a 2007 number. The court had testimony in two forms. It had Exhibit E, which was the mother's interrogatory responses, which listed out the reasonable needs of the child that we had asked her for in the spring of 2007, she had responded to, and then it had her testimony on top of that from August 2007. But rather, what did it do, the trial court? As noted in paragraph 8 of the August 31st, 2007 order, the court adopted an amount of the child's needs that was over 3 years old, despite having the current information. That the court used an amount from a prior hearing when the evidence adduced at the August hearing revealed a different amount is by in itself an abuse of discretion. Where the statute is clear, the determination is to be made at the time of the hearing. You just have to look at the Huff case for that, when they talked about what were the marital assets, the fact that the parties had been separated for God knows how many years, 15, 20 years. But the court said it's at the time of the hearing we look at the situation.
And Exhibit E was discovery you conducted in anticipation of this particular hearing?
Right, and was a stipulated exhibit also at the hearing, both.
It's an interrogatory answer.
It was an interrogatory answer. We said, please identify. Had the court evaluated the child's reasonable needs at the August 2007 hearing in accordance with In Remarriage of Upson and Van Inwagen, it could not have come up to the amount of the needs. And to begin with, the mother included in her expenses in the August 2007 hearing several costs which she admitted on the witness stand she did not incur. The court found roughly $5,100, $5,200 worth of reasonable needs of the child, of which $2,400 from the evidence was a mortgage payment she doesn't have. At least she didn't have in August 2007. She didn't have a mortgage. She lived in a house free and clear. She also had a transportation expense of $473, which she admitted she didn't have. She didn't have that car payment. Neither of these expenses, which total almost $2,900, which is almost two-thirds of what the court found were the reasonable needs of the child, aren't incurred. Under the Court of Appeals decision in In re Mackey, you cannot impute expenses which are not incurred by a party when determining child support. In fact, the Colorado Child Support Commission in 1991 uttered a similar pronouncement, and I quote, "To require the obligor to be responsible for costs that are not actually incurred and which are speculative in nature seems patently unfair." And that's the exact situation we faced in this case. And if the court had used the 2007 numbers rather than going back to 2004, it would have been able to come up to a reasonable amount, which we believe, based on these two numbers alone, is roughly $2,100, as we point out in our brief.
Is that where the 2171 number comes from?
Yes, exactly.
It's reverse engineered by backing that.
It's reverse engineered. The third component of that, Your Honor, there's a slight component of that, which is the mother's attorney's fees, which she admitted she included in the reasonable needs of the child. You can't do that, Your Honor. We have 1410.119, which is the attorney's fees statute. That those attorney's fees that mother was including in her calculation of the child's reasonable needs came from prior hearings that mother and father had. They were hearings regarding parenting time. There were hearings regarding some child support issues. There were hearings in front of Judge Plout on CFI, child advocate issues. It wasn't a CFI back at that time. But what she was doing was doing an end run around 1410.119. So that's how we reverse engineer, Your Honor, back to the $2,100 figure. On this point, Your Honor, the court's order of 4350, which is the current order, is almost double these reasonable needs. On this point, the mother argues that the child should benefit from father's good fortune. This is not a lottery case, Your Honor. This is not a case similar to Bone or McCord. First of all, this is not a standard of living case. Both of these parties, they have millions, both of them. The trial court found both of them have millions. Mother's in liquid assets, father's in illiquid assets. But both of them have millions. This is not a higher standard of living case as the lottery cases are. We certainly understand those cases, and they make sense, but not in this context. In this situation, Your Honor, we have a situation where mother has chosen not to work, perfectly acceptable. She has the money not to. She doesn't have a mortgage. She doesn't have a car payment. Father works 80-plus hours a week. They both enjoy high standards of living. Mother testified, and this is the point I want to make before I sit down and reserve my time. Mother testified that this child wants for nothing, that really she doesn't get things that she might otherwise buy her that she could under the standard of good parenting. That's a fine decision to make. But you can't then turn around and make the father responsible for 100% of the child support. It doesn't make any sense. This situation, Your Honor, is in essence, by ordering child support from $3,000 to $4,350 and not reducing it, quite frankly, to $2,100 or below, is a transfer of wealth that's improper under the Huff and Sewell cases. This is, in essence, a de facto maintenance case. If the child is not going to benefit from any additional support, which mother says she's not going to, that was her testimony, then in essence, we've got a de facto maintenance. And mother waived maintenance in the separation agreement. In the party separation agreement in 1998, mother waived maintenance. So we've got this de facto maintenance being paid in all this additional funds. Your Honor, I'm just going to reserve the rest of my time. If the court has no questions.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Stanley Lipkin, registration 5274, appear on behalf of Laura Brown, formerly Laura Hicks. Depending on time and questions, I'd like to address separately first of all, the answers to the appellate brief and the cross-appellant issues. From our point of view, we think the case law very amply supports the ability of this court to increase the child support. The whole focus of the father in his argument here is that we had past financial affidavits about what was actually spent on the child. That defines the needs. That's the end of the inquiry. We can now restrict the child to those needs. But we submit that the child support guidelines do not define a child's needs based upon what has been spent in the past. The income shares model actually defines a child's needs as a proportion of the combined incomes of the parents. And yes, Bone and McCord are both lottery cases, and they do exemplify the illogical character of trying to pin the child's needs to the past expenses, Of course, in the lottery cases, parents are from relatively modest income. It seems like that occurs more than not. And there was no money to spend, so no money was spent. And the father comes in now at the lottery and says, oh, you can't go above what was spent before. That defines the child's needs. Now, although those are lottery cases, they cite and build from NEMO, which is certainly not a lottery case. And NEMO stands for the proposition that the child should be sharing a portion of the combined incomes of the parents, and that's to alleviate the impacts of divorce, where the child would have 100% access to the income and resources of both parents.
Could you address, either now or later in your argument, your adversary's assertion that the mother testified that the child already enjoys an abundant lifestyle and would not get any, which would not get any better even if child support was increased?
Well, I think there was contrary testimony. There was a mixture of testimony on that. The mother did testify that the child noticed the difference in her standard of living at the two houses. She noticed, you know, that they were doing better things and living in a much more sumptuous environment in father's house. The child was aware of those things. And the mother also testified that as the child had gotten older, and this litigation in child support has gone on for quite some time, as you know, that the child's needs had increased. Children, you know, don't get cheaper as they get older, as we know. So there was testimony on both sides of that issue. She was adopting a relatively modest lifestyle, but there's no reason under the guidelines why this child's needs have to be pinned to what has been spent in the past. The child should enjoy the advantages of the father. I'd submit, in some sense, this father wins the lottery every year.
Mr. Lipkin, yes. What's the rationale that says that if father chooses to live in a more luxurious lifestyle and mother chooses not to, that somehow if father has to pay more child support to mother on behalf of the child, that somehow the child's now going to live more luxuriously? I just can't follow that logic.
Well, I think it comes from the guidelines, in terms of the child having access to the resources and income of both parents. I think that's an entitlement of the child under our guidelines.
So then the fact that father is living more luxuriously really then is irrelevant. What matters is what their relative assets are, and is the child getting an appropriate proportion of relative assets?
Well, actually, yeah, I would say more relative incomes than assets. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
I agree. And I think the quote from Mackey that's been used in the brief and in argument here today is taken out of context. Mackey is quoted in the opening brief as standing for the proposition that only expenses that are actually incurred can be included to determine the child's reasonable needs. Well, Mackey wasn't a case like our case here. The context for that decision in Mackey was, if you impute income to a parent, must you also impute daycare? That was the limited question in that case, not as to every need of the child. That was the hypothetical that they were dealing with. So I don't think it really applies to the argument in this case.
Well, in that regard, could you embellish on your adversary's assertion that the wife here included in her statement of needs a mortgage payment that she wasn't making, a car payment that she wasn't making, and her attorney fees?
I think it comes from the length of the litigation. I think, or actually, she was probably attributing the fair value of the residence she was applying partly in terms of the expenses she was listing.
Was that,
that asset was devoted
and is living in her new husband's house?
This asset was devoted to this child.
Okay, but she's not paying for it.
Yes.
So how can that be a component of the child's reasonable needs?
Well, I don't think any of our view is, I don't think any of the expenses are the defining thing of the child's needs. It's the resources of the parents. It's the combined incomes. That we don't start with past expenditures under our child support guidelines and say, This is defining the needs.
So are you saying the actual expenses are, or if the actual expenses are irrelevant?
The model doesn't use the expenses. The child support guideline doesn't employ expenses. It's nowhere in the calculation. It's the incomes.
Well, let me ask you this. If it's based on the incomes, what is your response to the argument made that the evidence of father's income was disregarded by the court improperly?
Well, I think what happened there was the question of whether he would take that tax loss that year. And I don't think it was evidence that he had actually taken it. I think it was a credibility of whether he would actually take that loss. That's all that was. And in a way, it's focusing on the trees instead of the forest. Even with that, the parents' combined incomes here are way above the guidelines. And the court then still has to exercise its discretion. It's not a simple calculation from the guidelines given these incomes.
Did the magistrate make a specific finding of substantial and continuing changed circumstances that would support departure from the prior child support?
I believe he did in part in his order, in when he went through that the testimony of the mother. In paragraph 8 of the magistrate's order, he says, the court finds Exhibit C, as well as co-petitioner's testimony on the expenses, incredible. Petitioner, on the other hand, testified at this hearing that her monthly expenses attributable to Melinda had increased due to the child's age and paying for the child to participate in age-appropriate activities, in addition to other benefits the child enjoys as a result of her parents' income. So I think he made those findings that there had been some change.
Well, but okay, but did he make a finding that they were substantial and continuing? I mean, I don't see it.
I don't think the words are actually there.
Okay, and is the testimony referenced in paragraph 8 including things like the mortgage payment that wasn't made and the car payment that wasn't made? I mean, it's not what it says, but is the underlying testimony include those arguably illusory expenses?
Yes. I believe the exhibit that was referred to by the husband, the exhibit C, was her expenses. Hard to remember exactly what the exhibit was at this point. Now, there's also the argument made by appellant that the standard of living is irrelevant in high-income cases, but I think that's unsupported by case law in the briefs. There's one Delaware case cited which doesn't even follow its own child support model, and even that case had a holding in it that in high-income cases there are what's called enhanced needs of the child, and it sent that case back for a determination. I'd like to address briefly the cross-appeal issues. Now, it's our point of view in this case that the final order in this case should be the magistrate's ruling, not the judge's ruling, because there wasn't a timely petition to review. And I've gone through in detail in the brief CRM 7A, which has that 15-day time limit, which was missed. And it's not just to ask for an extension, it's to file a petition for review, which in this case came some 60 days later. It wasn't timely. The rule is very clear. We think that the judge, when he entered his order, had no jurisdiction under CRM 7 at that point. We think, in fact, since it's a condition precedent to an appeal, that even this court has no jurisdiction at this point. They did not file timely on that matter. The other, and of course, the reason that my client has a very strong interest in maintaining the magistrate's order as opposed to the judge's order is that she got an award of attorney's fees in that case by the magistrate, which was thrown out by the judge's subsequent ruling. The magistrate supported his findings under 1410.119 by finding gross disparity in the incomes and assets of the parties. Ratio is something like 4.5 to 1. And the statute says clearly, that CRM 7A12, that the magistrate's finding are final unless clearly erroneous. There's nothing in the judge's order that points to error in those findings. The judge just in one sentence throws out the attorney's fee award. We think even on the merits, if there weren't the problem of jurisdiction, there's a sufficient basis both in the findings of the magistrate and in the course of this litigation to justify an attorney's fee award in this case. This is a case that is the culmination, the next step in 7 years of litigation with three motions to modify, three appeals, one petition for writ, and the child support and more has been expended on litigating and trying to protect it. And we believe, and I put forth a line of cases in our brief that says the court can actually consider the conduct. Here where the father alleges that would be a denial of his due process, that's not the problem. The problem is that the courts have been very indulgent of the father having more than due process. This is the third round on virtually the same thing. And mother keeps spending the money to try to keep her child support, and the money is lost. The money is deprived of the child because she puts out more in litigation to protect it than the amount that's at issue. So we think this is a very appropriate case to reinstate that award of attorney's fees and for the court to consider an award for appellate fees also. Those are my remarks, unless there are further questions. Thank you. That's five.
Your Honors, this is not a sudden acquisition of wealth case. The court can see that from the record. It can see it from even the trial court's findings. In response to Mr. Lipkin's comments, the district court in its January 23, 2008 order did issue findings. It's a one-sentence finding, but it's a finding regarding the attorney's fees. And it said, no action by the court is necessary to place these parties on equal footing, citing to 1410.119, citing to the Andrews versus Andrews decision. That is sufficient findings for the court to vacate the magistrate's finding on the attorney's fees. With regard to the issue of the 2006 loss and whether it was taken, put into context where we are in the year. It's August 2007. The father's tax return is on extension through October 15th. So the tax return hadn't been filed yet, but the father did testify about it. Your Honors hit it right on the head. This is a situation where both parties have significant assets. Mother has adopted a modest lifestyle. That's perfectly fine. It's her choice when she has the resources. This is not a case where she doesn't have the resources. Final 2 points, Your Honors. My time is running out. The timeliness argument, quite frankly, to me it's almost frivolous, and I shudder to say that any time. But a motion for extension of time was properly filed, unopposed. The court, because we want to talk about burdening on court time, didn't get around to signing the order. But in essence, by ruling in January of 08 on the merits, sub silentio had granted the order. I would submit to you if the dismissal of the appeal based on that, on the trial court's failure to grant the unopposed motion for extension of time, that would in and of itself be an abuse of discretion.
And you recited in the motion that it was unopposed?
Yes.
And that's never been controverted?
Absolutely not. Mr. Lipkin didn't controvert here. And it was for the purpose of obtaining the transcript, which both sides cited to at great length in getting to the district court. Finally, Your Honor, the attorney's fees, my time's up. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of counsel. The case stands submitted and counsel are excused. A written opinion will